Welcome to Cloak and Dagger, a show that exposes the cloak so you can see the daggers that are aimed at us all. They're still trying to kill us. Listen, Bob, the propaganda this week is killing me. Now, I have to apologize for bringing you out of the comfort of your safe house in Manhattan and asking you to come here face to face. But please, Bob, please turn it off.
Well, you're making the mistake, Lenny, of realizing that the media and propaganda is not directed at us or humans. It's not directed at surplus flesh.
It's killing us.
It's not killing us. If you realize that, you don't have to listen. It's directed to other media. That's the nature of the Android meme.
Well, there we go.
The Android meme.
We've already started with the Android meme.
Let's explain the Android meme before we go to our first guest, Bob, so people that have not heard this show will understand what you're talking about.
The Android means a technological simulation, an environment that's both outside of us and inside of us that doesn't let humans get a word in edgewise. And that's the experience every one of us on the planet has, and I am not denying it. This is it.
Well, that's true, because we have to cut to commercials a lot. That would be part of the Android meme.
I got to discuss the Android meme over the air last week during the commercials with Alex Jones.
Well, everybody knows that they can call in and ask us questions. As a spy pilot, I've flown assassins around the world. And so I have a lot of assimilation and feeling for these guys who flew into this building. But I sure wish those Talibanis had signed a pipeline deal with the Bush Leaguers. If they had, those twin towers would have still been standing today and the victims would have been alive.
Well, you know what? If anyone doesn't agree with that, we want to hear from
them. Yeah, call in.
Here we go. 416-870-64-uh-oh. That's your number. If you've got a cell phone, you can just hit *640. And, of course, Agent 11, the beautiful Agent 11 is here. How you doing, baby?
Very well. Thank you. And yourself, Jacob?
Well, I'm actually in Too Deep. I'd like to change my name from now on. My name is Too Deep. I've decided since Bob came up here and he's been telling me what's been going on in America, I'm in Too Deep.
How about Dupe Throat?
Dupe Throat will work, too, because as long as people know that I don't know what I'm talking about, I'll be safe.
David Shippers has been very much involved in the events that we've been reading about over the last few years and was very much involved in the impeachment of President Clinton. So let's go right into it. Welcome to the show, David.
Thank you very much. Can I be known as Sore Throat?
All right. So tell us a little bit about your background and what you have done to Clinton.
Well, my background is that I'm a lifelong Chicagoan. I was, have been, and still am a registered Democrat here in Cook County. In 1998, I was brought out to Washington by Congressman Henry Hyde, and I headed up I was the chief investigative counsel for the House Judiciary in the impeachment inquiry and in the ultimate impeachment of William Jefferson Clinton. And then I was the chief counsel for the managers during what we laughingly refer to as a trial in the Senate.
Well, you know, that would make you the most famous guest we've ever had on this show, probably on Mojo Radio. Lenny, you have a question.
Yeah, David, why don't you take us through leading up to 9/11? We learned about you from the Alex Joneses tape, and Alex was on the show last week, and we had a terrific interview with him, and I just thought we'd pick up from the 9/11 Road to Tyranny stuff that we've been listening to from Alex.
Well, actually, my involvement was long before 9/11. I was contacted by a former investigative reporter down in Oklahoma City by the name of Jana Davis. This was like maybe February, early March of 2001, a long time before the 9/11 attack. Jana Davis furnished information to me and proof in my mind as an old prosecutor beyond a reasonable doubt of Iraqi and Middle Eastern contacts and connections, direct connections, in the Oklahoma City bombing. As a matter of fact, she's able and still is able to identify the John Doe number 2 who was immediately on the radar screen and then was suddenly off the radar screen.
That is amazing news, and of course everyone here at Cloak and Dagger has seen that footage and seen those two people in the vehicle.
Yeah.
And then CNN seemed to have just lost the mission to find that second person. The only people that seemed to care were people in Oklahoma.
That's right, and not too many of them. Jana Davis did a tremendous job. She was working on it. She's still working on it, even though she's no longer an investigative reporter. But beginning in January or February, some early 2001, I began trying to reach somebody in Washington to get them to reopen the Oklahoma City bombing case. Part of her evidence is a warning that was issued by the House of Representatives Joint Task Force on Terrorism and Unconventional Warfare beginning in February, 2 months before the bombing. The warning said that there was going to be a massive attack inside the United States. It was narrowed down more and more so that by the time the Oklahoma City federal building was bombed, they had narrowed it down to, I think it was 12 cities, 12 possible targets in the United States. No action or no efforts were made whatsoever to protect any of those 12 buildings. After the explosion, the immediate focus, the FBI put out an all-points bulletin over the Oklahoma State Police radio looking for this John Doe number 2 and other Middle Eastern type individuals. Suddenly that was taken off the air and everybody said there was no John Doe number 2 and so on and so forth. I've seen 22 sworn affidavits of people who identify this Hussein al-Husseini as John Doe number 2. They put him together with McVeigh in a tavern 3 days before the bombing. They put him together with McVeigh and Nichols at a motel the night before the bombing. They put him in the Ryder truck. They put him in one of the getaway cars, and so on. 22 separate affidavits.
That's incredible.
Well, the woman who did this took those affidavits to the FBI after the bombing because she felt that these were evidentiary material that should be turned over to the Bureau and let them do their job. The Bureau refused to take it. Later on, when she brought them to the Bureau in 1997 at the time of the McVeigh trial, they took the documents, they took the statements, but those statements have never surfaced. They've never been turned over to the McVeigh or the Nichols defense team. They've never surfaced at all. They disappeared into the bowels of the FBI.
Yeah, what about Hoppe Heidelberg and the whole story about how the FBI came to his house and threatened him because he was trying to investigate John Doe 2 and 3?
Yeah, that happened, and the FBI came out, and they also tried to intimidate other people. For example, Pat Briley, who's another individual down there who was doing his own investigation.
David, this is very difficult for a lot of people to believe because they have such an image of the FBI. And
it was difficult for me to believe. I've spent years, I've worked with the FBI, with FBI agents, and with federal agents all of my professional life, with and against them. I am the first one to stand up and swear as to the integrity of the street agents, the fellows who are out there every day of the week doing their job and trying to protect the American people. The bureaucracy in Washington is an entirely different matter.
Well, is this another Division 5 Guy Bannister? And the terms I'm using for those out there, these are the people who were involved in the Kennedy assassination. But is this another sort of a Guy Bannister, Division 5 FBI move where they're covering this thing up?
Well, there's no question it's being covered up. And I don't know. It had to be from authority on at the very top, either the Attorney General, who at the time, of course, was Reno, or the President himself. Certainly the head of the FBI, although I don't blame Louis Free because I think that the bureaucracy in Washington was lying to Louis Free and keeping things from him. They deliberately set out to cover up the whole Oklahoma City bombing and specifically to cover up the Middle Eastern connection to it. Now the Congress is suddenly waking up. They're starting to look into it. There's just too much there. It can't be covered up anymore after 9/11. I represent an FBI agent here in Chicago. He is still a Bureau agent.
Mm-hmm.
This guy had some of the people that they're now looking for in his sights on criminal investigations here in Chicago and out in other areas, including an individual who actually set up terrorist training camps in Chicago and Kansas City and trained terrorists in how to make truck bombs.
Right.
He was shut down in 1998. He was told he would no longer conduct any criminal investigations. He was essentially shut down.
Now, on our website, cloakanddagger.ca, which you can get to through themojoradio.com, there's an interview with Benton Parton, who is one of the top men in the Pentagon, and he was very much involved in doing an investigation of Oklahoma City.
General Parton?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And did a forensic study showing that the building was blown up from explosives within the building. Are there not enough people and enough powerful men outside of this thing in order to break through the cover-up?
Well, we're doing our best to break through it right now. And the House of Cards seems to be tottering. I think the 9/11 attack on the Twin Towers finally pointed out to the American public and to their, quote, leaders, unquote, that the intelligence gathering ability of the America, of the United States, was seriously, seriously flawed. And people now are looking around saying, well, gee, how could this happen? Well, anybody who was acquainted with the facts of the Oklahoma City bombing and of the Flight 800 bombing would know how it could happen, because they just ignore everything that comes to them.
Jennifer in Toronto, thank you for calling.
Hi. I had seen a newscast about that very reporter, investigative reporter, woman, talking about all of these other citizens who brought forward affidavits saying that they had seen McVeigh with some Middle Eastern men and that they were somehow involved in renting the truck. And, I mean, I'm looking at this and thinking, man, I mean, what does this all mean? It wasn't a bomb in the truck. There were bombs in the building. Was this a dry run? I mean, did anybody else see this newscast? It was on, you know.
I don't know where you saw this. I saw it because Alex Jones from the U.S., who is one of my favorite watchdogs for this kind of thing, he sent a video to us, and it was from Oklahoma City itself. So, yes, I've seen it. I don't know where did you see it, Jennifer?
Well, this was a woman who was interviewed, I believe, on CNN, or it might have been in MSNBC, and she was a former reporter, investigative reporter, who to this day is still questioning why the FBI has, you know, basically been zipped up and not commenting or investigating any of this information that she put forward years ago on the Oklahoma thing.
Well, have you got a question for David, Jennifer?
Well, I'm just wondering if he saw that newscast.
All right, David?
I not only saw the newscast, I've been part of them. I set up the first newscast for Jana Davis with Bill O'Reilly on Fox News here in the States.
Right.
And I think the newscast you're talking about was on MSNBC.
Yep.
She was on a number of times with Fox News, but we couldn't get any breakthrough on the major media here in the States. Finally, we got a breakthrough with this case where she appeared on MSNBC. There was also last week a full-page article about her and about Lori Milroy, who, as you know, investigated the first Twin Towers attack, and that appeared in the Wall Street Journal. Since that time, we've been getting all... See, I represent Jana Davis.
You know, I got to tell you something. This really stinks. It smells like conspiracy. It smells like JFK, you know, 2002 instead of, you know, 1963. There's something wrong here.
Well, there's a lot here. When you look at the whole thing, you'll see that it's a major conspiracy, and it was covered up. There were a lot of Middle Eastern men all around this building. And that's the reports, John Doe 1, John Doe 2, 3. They were all just nicely covered up and put away. And there's even reports that the sniff dogs died of radiation poisoning. So there's a lot of other things going on here. It is a big story. They haven't even scratched the surface.
And let me tell you this, that the person who has been positively identified by more than 22 people in Oklahoma City, his background is that
this
during
is Hussein Husseini?
Yeah, during the Gulf War, he was a member of the Republican Guard, Hussein's Republican Guard. His cover story when he came over to this country was that he had broken with Hussein and therefore he had to get out of the country.
Phony story.
There's a whole cadre of them down there in Oklahoma City. And they're here, they're up in Buffalo, New York, up near you. They're all over. And
and if they're listening to the show, call in.
Yeah, come on. Yeah,
come on, guys.
Well, we have more calls, so let's go over to Phil right now. Phil, please turn on your radio.
Yeah, hello?
Yes.
Yes, how you doing?
Very good.
Okay, I'm calling because I have a couple reports that I read, and I got them off the Internet, with regards to Bush having something to do with September 11th as a way of him to invade Iraq as an excuse. And he was something to do with for the oil, to take over the oil. Okay, and I've got numerous reports of this. I've downloaded it off the Internet, and I just find it very suspicious now. And especially
Remember that the man who was a consultant to UNICAL became president of Afghanistan. Afghanistan is an area that's right in the way of preventing the American oil companies from bringing their product to market because the pipeline has to go through Afghanistan. So there's a lot of evidence and reason and motives to try and find a way to as I said at the top of the show, if the Talibanese had signed a pipeline deal with the Bush leaguers, there'd be no need to bring down the Twin Towers. I think they brought down the Twin Towers because it was a way of getting America to go to war to get the troops into Afghanistan. And look what they did. The minute they got there, they put a UNICAL employee in charge of the Afghan government. I mean, come on, guys.
What did David Shipper say about this?
Well, I'll tell you, first of all, I don't have no evidence whatsoever of any link between the president and 9/11. And I'll tell you, if they wanted to, let's assume that everything you said is true, and a lot of the facts are true. There's no question about it. That pipeline is vital, and the people involved are exactly who you say they are. But let's assume that President Bush and his administration wanted to get evidence on Hussein sufficient to go to war. It was all there at Oklahoma City. It was all there. All they had to do was open up those FBI files and start showing the American people that Oklahoma City and Flight 800 were both Iraqi attacks on the United States, which they were. And they would have had all the evidence they needed. In fact, they would have had more evidence than they've got now. For example, I'm going to give you a classic example of how things are covered up. The case against Massawi up in the fellow from Minneapolis who wanted to learn how to fly planes but didn't want to know how to land them or take them off. One of the biggest problems that the government keeps telling us they have is that they have no evidence directly connecting Massawi with any of the actual hijackers. One of the individuals at a motel in Oklahoma City that Jaina Davis has been interviewing in August of 2001, about a month before the Twin Towers went, he had three Middle Eastern individuals come in and try to hire a room for a week. They told him that they were going to be attending flight school in Norman, Oklahoma. This guy stood and talked to those three individuals for 20 minutes in full light, facing them not more than 3 feet away. He has positively identified one of those three individuals as Massawi. He has positively identified another of those individuals as Mohammed Atta, the guy that flew the plane
in
the tower.
Unbelievable.
Now, do you think the FBI has been down there to interview him?
No.
They didn't go near him.
Oh,
you know why? Do you know why?
Why?
Because this same person is the one that put McVeigh together with John Doe 2 in the Ryder truck in the parking lot of his motel the night before the Oklahoma City bombing. If they admit he's telling the truth now about Massawi, they have to admit he was telling the truth about that.
Catch
they'd rather lose Massawi.
All right. You're listening to Kogan Dagger on Mojo Radio, AM 640. Bob Dobbs has a question.
David, so it's not a mystery that Terry McNichols and McVeigh were linked with the Al-Qaeda in the Philippines in 94, 95, or...
No, that's right. They were... Nichols was over... Nichols, who didn't work at all, made something like 20 trips to the Philippines. He was down there in that area with the Abu Sayyaf. There's a testimony out of the Philippines putting a guy that they refer to as the farmer. That's Nichols. Together with Abu Sayyaf operatives and Al-Qaeda operatives over there.
I would suggest, is it because they didn't want Clinton to run the war in Iraq, they had to get someone like Bush in?
Well, no, I think what it, when I said that it was a decision made at the top, I mean at the top. If you'll recall, down here in the States in 1995, Clinton's numbers were way down. He had had some of the scandals had begun to surface. He was in great danger of being a one-term president. The last thing he needed was to have an Iraqi or a Middle Eastern attack on the United States in the heartland where he would have to act. His entire existence as President of the United States was domestic policy. He couldn't handle anything foreign, and he didn't want to handle anything foreign. I think the FBI's motive, and I'm talking about the bureaucracy now, the Washington bureaucracy's motive was that had they admitted that they dropped the ball back in 1995, we all would have known then what we know now, that the FBI was a total bust as far as protecting the United States.
Do you see then that Clinton made this move and he was left? Is this the kind of stuff you wanted to bring up in your trial?
No, but I'll tell you, one of the managers of the impeachment in the Senate was Congressman Bill McCollum from Florida. Bill McCollum was also on that task force, the Task Force on Terrorism and Unconventional Warfare, and Bill McCollum wanted to turn that over to me and my staff to investigate during the impeachment inquiry. Would that he had, because then we would have started, I would have dug into that like we dug into the other peccadilloes that involved our former president. But the leadership in the House of Representatives shot it down. They said, no, we're not going to go into it. We're not going to start. We're not going to open that door, and we're not going to overturn that rock. Once again, the good, I suppose you could say, the safety of the American people was secondary to the cowardice of the leadership in the House and Senate.
All right, there's an answer for you. Now over to John and Mississauga. Thank you for holding.
Good evening. A couple of points. One's related to what you guys are saying. And firstly, though, is it true that I hear that one of the passports of the hijackers on one of the planes that flew into the World Trade Center was found in the rubble?
That's, I understand that's true.
Well, that's interesting. And also, I think it was Muhammad Atta who's on the, or I'm not sure if it was him, but one of the guys who was on the wanted posters put out by the FBI, all of a sudden, a couple of days after, relatives say they've seen him or that he's showing up in some way, shape, or form.
Well, if he showed up, it'd be in the form of a ghost, because he apparently was vaporized along with everybody else.
That's what I assume. Okay. Now, in relation to the Oklahoma City bombing,
yeah.
How many Iraqi ex-soldiers, and I'm not even sure if they were from the Republican Guard, if you can clarify, were brought over into the Oklahoma City area? I'm aware that a number of them were.
A great number of them were, and it was another tremendous breakdown. It was our Department of State and the immigration people that just let them in without any investigation, any background investigation at all. Jaina Davis attempted to do some background on some of those people down there, and she just ran into dead ends. Now, you know, if somebody comes in and tries to get into the United States, coming from a country that we had just been at war with, and that person, just example, go back to Nazi Germany, somebody came in, tried to get into the country and said, I'm German, but I was anti-Nazi, and you started trying to look into his background and ran into a dead end, you'd never let him in. But our immigration service was so completely disrupted, so completely destroyed during the Clinton years, that they had no method of checking people out or of screening these people. They came in by the hundreds.
All right.
And they spread around the United States, and they're still there.
All right, we're going to go over to Peter in Niagara Falls. You are listening to Cloak and Dagger on Mojo Radio. Peter, thank you for holding.
Hi, gentlemen. Mr. Shippers, do you remember shortly after 9/11, I think it was only a few days after, when the SEC, with great fanfare, opened up an investigation into the short selling of the airline stocks, and we haven't heard a peep since?
That was, I remember that very clearly. I remember that there was supposed to be a tremendous investigation because it had shown that there was a great deal of short selling, and they thought that perhaps this was another method for the terrorists to make money. I'm convinced that it was. I'm convinced that, from what I know, based upon my contacts here in Chicago with agents and with people who've been working on this all over the country, I'm talking about the real agents. They're the Al-Qaeda, Hamas, Hezbollah, and all of them. They are in this country. They have infiltrated the United States. I don't know if they've infiltrated Canada, but I assume that they've tried that too. And what they're doing is violating every conceivable law in the United States to get money and to get funds to fund terrorism all over the world. And they're getting away with it. The FBI agent that I represent in Chicago actually had traced how the money moves, how it's handled, how the type of money laundering that is done, the laws that are being violated, and this is three years before 9/11, and he was told he had to stop. He couldn't do anything.
David, one of our regular guests, Sherman Skolnick, lives in Chicago. He has been on about this 400 Iron Guard people coming over the last two or three, maybe more years since Oklahoma. Are you in touch with Sherman Skolnick?
I know Sherman. I've known him since I was in the government, and he was a watchdog. He had a watchdog group of Chicago here in Chicago watching over the judges and the courts and stuff like that. I have a lot of respect for Sherman.
Has he helped you in this case, or have you helped him?
Neither. I haven't really been in touch with him on this case. I have the contacts that have been calling me from all over. I mean, I began getting information in about April or May of last year, of 2001, that the terrorists and the terrorist groups, Hamas and that gang, had come up with a tripartite plan to attack the United States. One, they were going to down an American plane. That was Flight 800. Two, they were going to bomb a federal building in the heartland. And the third one, now two of them had come true. The third one that I was hearing was going to be the final blow was a massive attack in Lower Manhattan.
And David, with TW-800, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and Benton Parton and some witnesses took out a full-page ad in the New York Times claiming that two missiles hit TW-800, that the National Transportation Safety Board had covered it up and had changed the report.
Hundreds of witnesses.
That's precisely
right. So we've got warnings being given to the American people by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. We've got Benton Parton warning America that the bomb from Oklahoma, as he's a forensic expert,
right,
the expert of experts,
right,
he claims that it was a cover-up. So you've got the top people in the United States, some of the most top authorities like yourself in their area saying this, and yet the propaganda is able to keep the American people totally brainwashed.
Let me tell you this. I suspected Flight 800 from the day it happened. I recall the original report said that there were 150 or 200 people who actually saw an explosion on the plane.
Mm-hmm.
I gave a talk here in Chicago in one of the western suburbs last year. And after the talk was over, an individual came up to me and he said, "Mr. Shippers, my name is whatever." And he said, I want you to know that I have been a commercial airline pilot on international flights for 25 years. He said, "I was on my approach to Kennedy National in New York. Flight 800 was a couple of planes in front of me, and I saw the missile hit."
Yep.
He said, "Between us was an Air France plane that took immediate evasive action without any prior authority just to get out of the blast." And I said, "Well, what did you do?" He said, "Well, as soon as I landed, I called the FBI. They sent out one agent who spent about 2 minutes with me, told me he'd be back in touch, and I've never heard another word."
Well, if you have the power to knock off the president at high noon within 40 yards of the sheriff's desk,
yep,
then you can easily start to muscle out chairmen of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And if you can take out the commander-in-chief, then you can just ignore years later other top members of the Pentagon.
I'm afraid you're right.
A question from Bernadette in Peterborough. She was wondering if Mr. Shippers has any observations to share with us about the Pentagon. She's read that no plane debris was ever shown on any news report and that it was a bomb. Are there any comments?
You know, I've heard that a number of times. I was out in Washington, within a month of the Pentagon bombing. And I had a lot of friends out there. When we were working against the immortal Mr. Clinton, we lived down in Alexandria, which is just south of the city. And we would drive past the Pentagon every day. I talked to 6 or 8 people who actually saw the plane hit the Pentagon. It barely missed an office building immediately across the street and then rammed right into the Pentagon. And they took me over there and showed me where it went. Nobody ever found any airplanes either on the in the Twin Towers, because when you hit at that speed with that type of jet fuel going off, everything is just incinerated. And you will note that nobody ever found any parts of an airplane after those bombing of the Twin Towers either.
All right. Over to Lenny. Yeah,
David, when we take a look now at 9/11, as researchers, we understand that it's on the record as to the way in which the FBI covered up Oklahoma's bombing, and we also are familiar with how the FBI is on the record with admitting, out of the New York Times, it's been reported that they have admitted that they hired the men who bombed Oklahoma in 1993, and even the World Trade Center in 1993.
The original World Trade Center.
Yeah, the World Trade Center. Yeah. Original bombing. And what's falling through the cracks now on 9/11 that you can talk about? What haven't we gotten into that has fallen through the cracks? Because there's just so many...
That relates to the FBI.
That relates to the
FBI. Well, not only the FBI, it's all of the intelligence.
David, did you know John O'Neill?
I know of him. I don't know him.
All right.
And who is he, Bob? Why don't you tell us who he is? If you're gonna...
David, tell us who John O'Neill is.
No, go ahead.
John O'Neill was the man who wanted to investigate the Bin Laden family. The FBI told him to buzz off. He then did an interview with the French people, and you can get the book. It's out there somewhere. And then he quit the FBI, and his first day on the job, or first few days on the job, was September 11th, and he died in the crash.
I'll tell you, there are an awful lot of FBI agents that have talked to me and have called me from all over the United States. Had there been any kind of coverage, any kind of central location to handle intelligence information, there would have been no 9/11. I'll give you an example. Down in Phoenix, Arizona, an agent noted that there were a whole bunch of strange things going on in flight schools. A number of Middle Eastern types were going there, speaking in Arab, and they were taking flight instructions. At about the same time, the agent up in Minneapolis came up with information saying that here's a guy who went to a flight school, Middle Eastern again, and all he wanted to do was learn how to fly a plane. He didn't care how to land it or take it off. He just wanted to know how to steer it straight. All along prior to 9/11, there were little bits of information coming forward. But what happened was the agent in Washington, the bureaucrat in Washington who got the information on Phoenix, put it in a drawer. The agent who got the information from Minneapolis put it in a drawer. They never talked to one another. Obviously, the hints, the information was there if they'd only looked, but they didn't look.
Okay, David. Alex Jones' video features the road to tyranny. Aside from your general feelings of depression you must have for the state of your country, what would you do now and advocate Canadians or even Americans who are hearing the show? How do they respond to this cover-up?
Well, the Americans, of course, it's up to us, because it's our people that have done it, but it's up to the American people to rise up, demand of their legislators, and demand of their president that he clean this thing up. The answer to a bureaucratic mess-up is not to create another bureaucracy, which is what they're trying to do now with this Homeland Defense business. You don't need 70,000 individuals. You need 150 good agents who've been told that they can go out there and do their job. I could pick that 150 agents from the people I know, and they will stop this. They will stop it dead in its tracks.
I'd also like to introduce our guest for the second hour, Ralph Shulman. He's on the line. He investigated the JFK assassination with the Bertrand Russell Tribunal, and he's an authority on this. He was very influential in Jim Garrison's life and getting his first book published and a contract for the second book, a novel. Ralph will be underneath listening, and we'll have him respond to us later when we get into the JFK movie.
That's beautiful. Over to Video Dave. Video Dave, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. I also want to mention that we have live in the studio from Pacific Palisades, California, Robert Tascher, the director of a 9/11 video that we're going to be talking about also. The first thing I want to say is that we're going to talk about JFK, the Oliver Stone film from 1991. Now, I just want to start off at the top by saying there's no analysis of the film JFK's artistic work, worth, or individual performances or cinematic achievements, or even the story's place in relation to history or truth can compete with the great debate. Now, what I mean by that is long before the movie-going public had seen the final film, writer-director Oliver Stone and the film itself became immersed in an angry multimedia public brawl over veracity, propriety, and, of course, the C word. And what I mean by the C word is conspiracy. Now, any attempt to put Stone's 188-minute opus in perspective must begin with a look at 28 years of claims and counterclaims, theories born, witnesses dying, mystery, and deceit. Here's my question. With JFK, has Oliver Stone created a film biography of D.A. Jim Garrison, or has he created in Kevin Costner's character a mythological everyman of the various critics and researchers throughout the last 30 years?
All right. Now, did you want to gear that over to
Bob? I want to gear it to the panel, whoever who...
All right. Bob Dobbs, any question? Any comment?
Bob or Lenny?
Well, go ahead. Bob, you want me to...
Go ahead.
Is this from a biography of Garrison, or is it...
I think it's a biography of Garrison, because I think Jim Garrison has to be one of the greatest American heroes ever in American history, because he went up against a huge, powerful group, and his life was on the line, and his family, he lost his wife, he lost his family. They weren't killed, but certainly they wouldn't support him because the propaganda just demolished him. I think it's very much a story about Jim Garrison.
I would add that the second point is valid. It is about the archetypal critic and researcher, too. So Oliver Stone brilliantly has multiple levels. It's the traditional technique of the double plot.
So there's a mythological element that resides.
Yeah, the literary term is the double plot. In King Lear, you have the other father having problems with his sons, as you have King Lear with his daughters. That's the way you create the motion of multitude, that this applies to everybody. This is universal.
Beautiful. Having said that, Lenny, let's go to the clip.
All right, let's go to the clip.
Yeah, let's just introduce the clip.
Absolutely.
Okay. This is the part of the movie when David Ferry, who was a contract pilot for the operation, who flew the shooters, the assassins in, and flew them out. He is talking with and under investigation, and is talking and being questioned by Garrison, and he then relays a story about the intelligence game and what it's like to work within it.
All right, let's roll the clip.
Man, you don't leave the agency. Once you're in there, they got you for life.
Shaw?
Shaw's an untouchable, highest clearance. Shaw, Oswald, Cuban's all agency.
What about Ruger?
Jack was a pimp. He was a bag man for the Dallas mob. He used to run guns to Castro when he was still on our side. We almost had Castro with us. Then we tried to whack him. Everybody's flipping his eyes all the time. It's fun and games, man. Fun and games.
What about the mob, Dave? How are they
figuring
this?
The agency, too, man. CIA and the mafia working together. Trying to whack out the beer. Mutual interest. They've been doing it for years. More than you could dream.
All right, and that was the section of Joe Pesci where he didn't swear. Brilliant clip.
The clip telling us, gentlemen.
Well, you have to understand that what the importance of Oliver Stone's film is that it is the first major dramatization of the investigation by Jim Garrison, the only public figure in the United States who actually attempted to address the role and the evidence for it of the intelligence agencies and of a major sector of the American ruling class in the execution of John Kennedy. And one of the things that you were referring to before, namely the unprecedented attacks upon the film even before the film had been released and the publication of its script in Newsweek and such, it was an indication of the extent to which the established media understood that the film had the opportunity and the capacity to bring to a large audience the overwhelming evidence that Garrison's investigation established. Now, as you know, we had established the Who Killed Kennedy Committee in London in 1964, and this is now at the time just after the assassination, and we brought Mark Lane at the time to London, where he wrote Rush the Judgment, actually in the flat of the Bertrand Russell Peace Foundation, my flat in London at the time. At that time in Italy, there was a newspaper called Paese Sera, which was an evening newspaper, but a daily with a circulation of almost 200,000 a day. It was a broad-left newspaper. And the Italians were very preoccupied in the late 60s about the prospect of a CIA-inspired military coup in Italy, because U.S. capitalism was most worried about a coalition government in Italy between the Communist Party and the Socialist Party, broad parties with together the largest base of popular support in Italy. And there were plenty of indications that Mussolini sympathizers and the intelligence agencies and the military in Italy were preparing a putsch, much as had occurred and would occur in Greece. So Paese Sera undertook a 6-month investigation into the role of the CIA in Italy. Their interest was the prospects of a putsch inspired by the CIA in Italy, not Dallas. But as it happened, this investigative report turned up the presence of something called Centro Mondiale Commerciale, which means World Trademark, in Italy, a proprietary organization of the Central Intelligence Agency, and a shadowy operation known as Permindex. And one of the figures who was involved in this, and who became persona non grata in Italy as a consequence, was a character named Clay Shaw, whose base was New Orleans, and who indeed returned to New Orleans, where he was heading up the International Trade Mart in New Orleans. We sent that report of Paese Sera and that investigative data to Jim in 1967, and it was one of the elements that enabled him to pursue the data and the evidence regarding Clay Shaw, David Ferry, and such.
Can I interrupt you for a second? Let me just, it must be stated that many people question the accuracy of Stone's information provided in the film. And having said the name Clay Shaw, let me give you an example. Oliver Stone presented the assassination of RFK on the eve of the Clay Shaw trial. Now, we all know that it actually occurred half a year before the trial began. So there's all these different sort of inaccuracies in terms of the information that Stone's providing.
Well, what's inaccurate about the information?
Well, first of all, here's another example. Oliver Stone implies in the film that the Texas Theater was a prearranged meeting point for Oswald.
That's true.
With an unknown associate. But if Stone had simply looked at a map, wouldn't he have seen that at the time he encountered Officer J.D. Tippit, Oswald was headed in the opposite direction, away from the theater? It was only after murdering Tippit that Oswald changed his course and took refuge in the theater.
Oswald never did murder anybody that day.
No, but Ralph has some good information on this. Go ahead.
By the way, I should mention that surprised that you're airing this sort of disinformation as if it were serious evidence. When we had the Who Killed Kennedy Committee in London, which had a number of very prestigious people affiliated with it, the conservative professor at Oxford, Hugh Trevor Roper, Arnold Toynbee, Field Marshal Sir Claude Auchinleck was a strong supporter, and a whole variety of people who were concerned to get at the evidence concerning the execution of the head of state in the U.S., 19 files of the district attorney's office at that time were liberated by an employee and sent to us in London. And amongst those files was the data concerning the presumptive role of Oswald in the killing of J.D. Tippit. The official evidence was clear, because the files showed that the woman who had identified the assailant, Helen Louise Markham, refused to identify Oswald as the assailant, and indeed identified the assailant as short, stocky, and bushy-haired. Oswald had no connection to the murder of J.D. Tippit. J.D. Tippit was taken out as an opportunity to pursue Oswald, and it's interesting to note, by the way, that Oswald was not charged with the murder of Kennedy. He was charged with the murder of Tippit. That was the pretext and the rationale. When Oswald was in the Texas Book Depository building, to which he had been sent as a meeting place, he was set up as a clay pigeon. And if you recall, when Oswald was detained, And he was asked after he had had the shit beaten out of him by the police, and the press asked him what he had to say about being charged with the murder of the president. He looked at them and he said, "Murder the president? Nobody's ever said anything to me about that. I've been told I'm supposed to have killed some cop named Tippit." Now, at the time, there was a Central Intelligence Agency intelligence analyst named George O'Toole, who had developed a technology which allowed you to determine from the timbre of voice the presence of lying or non-lying. It's a technique that's been used technologically by police departments across the country, far more accurate than lie detector tests and the like. And O'Toole applied this electronic technology to the tape of Oswald and came to the conclusion that Oswald was indeed telling the truth. The way it works is that the presence of stress when you are truth-telling is always possible when you are emotionally involved or there's something concerning you. But the absence of stress is absolutely incompatible with lying. And
okay, Ralph, we have to hold on. Are you saying you consider the film disinformation? You don't like the film?
You're speaking to me?
Yes, you, Ralph.
Not at all. I was just addressing this question of Oswald killing Tippit, which is a fiction, and Garrison was, Oliver Stone was perfectly accurate in exploding that fairy tale.
Absolutely.
As did Jim Garrison in his own investigative work.
Now, Ralph, what do you think of the movie?
I think the movie is a very important evocation of the massive evidence that Jim Garrison put together, and it is the first major, since Executive Action, the film that was with Burt Lancaster and Robert Ryan that Mark Lane and Donald Freed wrote, which is also an important film. But since that, Oliver Stone's movie is the first important mass evocation of the evidence and the role of the Central Intelligence Agency and of a sector of the American ruling class in the removal of Kennedy through a putsch. And as such, it has great importance. There are all kinds of aesthetic criticisms that you can make of the film, but I don't think that is so central to our understanding as the significance of the movie presenting for a mass audience the abundant evidence of the role of the agency and the case that Jim Garrison had assembled regarding this.
Video Dave, you have something for us.
Yeah, it's straight off the line. It's completely unrelated. I just want to mention that actor Bob Crane's story is coming to life. If you remember Bob Crane, he's best known for his hilarious 60s sitcom Hogan's Heroes. He was found murdered in 78 and his skull crushed by a camera tripod. It became one of Hollywood's most bizarre murder cases. Now director Paul Schrader has decided to bring Crane's story to the big screen. It'll be called Autofocus and will center on Crane's life after his sitcom fame. When the star became obsessed with videotaping his one-night stands. A video technician named John Carpenter was accused of the murder, but later acquitted after a lack of hard evidence. Shooting starts in December, and rumor has it already that the script is so detailed that it has sparked an interest in Carpenter's prosecutor to reopen the case. To this day, Bob Crane's murderer is still at large.
In the studio, we have Mr. Bob Tasher. Bob Tasher, big-shot Hollywood producer. He's been up to Toronto a couple of times before, and he has a film screening tomorrow night at the Bloor Cinema called Sherty Little Mouth. I've seen the pre-cut version of that film, and I highly recommend it. And, of course, you've just come back from the U.S. You were down there working on the 9/11 film. And before I get you to say anything, Mr. Tasher, I should tell people out there that you produced a film, the movie, the only thing that John Lennon and Marilyn Manson have in common. They both love The Holy Mountain. And so you have quite a crazy history. Welcome to the show. Could you please tell us a little bit about what made you want to do a film on 9/11? Where did that come from?
Well, that came from just an emotional reaction to the same thing that everyone else saw on 9/11. I was transfixed for several days in front of my television set in Los Angeles. I was there at the time. And as a filmmaker, I was just, I thought, what could I do to help after the events to promote some kind of debate in the United States in particular about why this happened.
Your angle wasn't conspiracy theory. It was an overall look at what is really happening.
Right. My point of view is more focused on foreign policy, American foreign policy. And I don't take the simplistic approach to the events of 9/11. Certainly it was a horrible tragedy, and I don't want to minimize that at all. But I think if you look at the world in terms of overall the geopolitical situation in the world, and you look at the history of the United States, particularly after World War II, and our activities around the world, and in large part concerning our stance, our anti-communist stance, and the kinds of involvements that our government has had around the world, that's what led me to my own particular conclusion about American foreign policy and its role in the events of 9/11.
Robert, were you inspired in a sense by the documentaries that came out in September, October, up to the CBS documentary in March about that level of presentation of witnesses and the local story? Were you trying to create an antidote to the general drift of documentaries on September 11th?
I'm not quite clear. Can you elaborate on that?
Did you see any of the films over the past week? The video and the coverage.
Well, yes, of course. I mean, I started my journey across the country. I put a small crew together and drove across the country the first week of October, about 3 weeks after the event. So it was not in reaction to any of the documentaries that have come out since.
But I've seen your documentary, and it is a different, soft, peaceful look at the situation. Question: trying to get people to ask the question, which was never asked: why did this happen? That kind of stuff was happening in September and October. Weren't you responding to the general media coverage?
Well, I was.
Or did you not know what you would find?
Yeah, I didn't know exactly what. I mean, I had my own point of view as to, you know, I've had a point of view, a political point of view for many years regarding a number of the, you know, particularly we were talking earlier about Vietnam, for example. I mean, I had a point of view about that. I was just out of college at that time, and it wasn't in response to anything in particular. It was just an overall point of view about the geopolitical situation and our government's involvement in it.
All right. Well, you were listening to Mojo Radio's Cloak and Dagger, and Video Dave has actually walked into the building, and I know why, because Bob Tasher is here, and you got all excited and came right down here in person.
Absolutely.
You have a question.
Well, Bob, I have to say, first of all, off the bat, that you're a wonderful filmmaker. Where's the general inspiration? Where did it come from? Where was it dormant? Was it always dormant post 9/11? I mean, the subject matter that you tend to embrace or associate yourself with in terms of directing films and producing films is a far cry from this little documentary. Where did it? Was it a labor of love post 9/11 for you? Is it something that you always had in a drawer that you were ready to take on?
Yeah, you know, if you go back to the Holy Mountain, you can take a look. There's some pretty strong political statements in that film. Although I did not write or direct that, I produced it. Yes, I would agree. The film that I'm up here to screen tomorrow night is far afield from this subject matter. But I did this from the point of view as an American citizen. I happen to be a filmmaker as well. And so I felt that I wasn't hearing anything on the subject of why this happened and about American foreign policy, and I felt compelled to add my voice. That's really the answer.
All right. Well, Bob Tasher, I will be seeing you tomorrow night. Can you give us information about your show? Is it the Bloor Cinema?
Yes, it's at the Bloor Cinema. I think it's at 9:30 tomorrow night,
PM,
Monday,
yes.
Monday evening, and anyone, go ahead, I'm sorry.
You'll be there. Immediately preceding the film, Bob, you'll be answering a Q&A session. So anybody who's interested in discussing the 9/11 the video that Bob has just been speaking of, or the actual film itself, Shut Your Dirty Little Mouth, you're welcome to come down to the Bloor Cinema at 506 Bloor Street West.
Bob Tasher, do you mind if I tell people my take on your film? Not the 9/11, because I haven't seen that yet, but I have seen Shut Your Dirty Little Mouth. I would say it's like The Odd Couple from Hell. If you imagine The Odd Couple living in Parkdale with a lot of booze.
Yeah, The Odd Couple meets My Dinner with Andre on acid.
Well,
or at the liquor store.
Right, thank you for
ounce of booze.
Thank you for the compliment, but... I would just say that we do have a website, shutyourdirtylittlemouth.com, so if anyone wants to, to check out the background, and we do have some streaming video from the film, some clips from the film in particular. We have the toenail scene. We have a number of scenes from the film, so if anyone wants to familiarize themselves with the film, if they're curious about it before they come down tomorrow, they can check out our website. And I want to thank you.
Thank you
for inviting me on your show.
I asked Ralph Showman to come on because I have mentioned in previous shows the significance of Jackson Stevens. Ralph has done a lot of work at WBAI and other stations on Jackson Stevens and how it overlaps with September 11th and the previous history of BCCI. But before we go to Ralph and what he's going to tell us about that, we did put up a bio that is an example of disinformation, isn't it, Ralph? What would you say about what we put up?
Well, as it happens, you took a bio off the internet that was put out by a supposed professor at the University of Rhode Island named Kenneth Ron, who teaches astronomy, but actually teaches as well a course in which purports to be about the JFK assassination. And basically what he does is to take each of the critical books, the books that establish the fiction of the official version, and tear them apart and to impugn the people who have written them. And he invented a biography for me in which he claims that I'm a supporter of Osama bin Laden, and he imputes to me the thesis that the Jews created the Holocaust and various items which are sheer fabrication characteristic of intelligence agency disinformation.
And Ralph, and it's the kind of stuff that happens when you're a controversial person like yourself, a researcher, a scholar, an investigator, a person who's written a book on Bertrand Russell, worked with Bertrand Russell in many causes in the 60s, helped Jim Garrison get his book contracts, was that with the Palestinian refugee camps in the summer of 82 when Erez Shiron went in, and you have a lot of kudos of credit of working with people in trade unions. And so therefore we put that up there to show you the kind of stuff you get when you are a person like Ralph Showman. So we're really proud to have you, Ralph.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I just want to mention that at the time that the U.S. had bombed the Shifa pharmaceutical plant in Khartoum in the Sudan on the pretext that this was biological and chemical weapons place that had been inspired by Osama bin Laden, I wrote a piece called Who Are the Real Terrorists? And documented that the Central Intelligence Agency had created the fundamentalist apparatus of Gulbuddin Mekhtar and of Osama bin Laden, giving them $6 billion, and the thesis was that the role of these people was that as operatives of the Central Intelligence Agency in Afghanistan, in Central Asia, and they were deployed as demons as a way for the oil companies and for U.S. rulers to grab the oil and natural gas of the region. And so the thesis was, who are the real terrorists? And on the strength of such an article, this guy presents us as supporters of Osama bin Laden, which is illustrative of the method. It's disinformation. But let me make a point to you about this whole category of conspiracy that has been brought up here, because the irony of it all, Bob, is that the most commonly invoked prosecutorial device at every jurisdictional level, whether it's city or county or state or federal, is that of conspiracy. Every prosecutor, district attorney, invokes category of conspiracy, whether it has to do with property cases or whatever. The only conspiracy that they have no interest in pursuing is that which involves people in high places.
Okay, Ralph, let's go into Jackson Stevens. That's your point's been made. Who is Jackson Stevens and why should we be interested in him?
Well, Jackson Stevens is a figure with the National Security Agency, and a multi-billionaire who has been a primary figure in the financing of both Democratic and Republican parties. And the interest in Jackson Stevens arises really from the
role of the presumptive hijackers as instruments of U.S. military and intelligence policy. You know that the presumptive hijackers, Mohammed Atta and Abdulaziz Al-Amari and Saeed Ahmadi, were all trained at U.S. military installations. Mohammed Atta was trained at the International Officers School at Maxwell Air Force Base in Montgomery, Alabama. Saeed Ahmadi was at the Defense Language Institute, a Defense Department Language Institute in Monterey, California. Abdulaziz Al-Amari was at the Aerospace Air Force Base in Texas. These people were trained as well at the Pensacola Naval Air Station and cleared through U.S. Air Force International Officers School, requiring U.S. Air Force sanction, which meant that they had to have top intelligence clearance in order to be admitted, let alone trained, at such places. This is reported and documented in Newsweek and in various established publications. Newsweek's internet site reported that three of these hijackers received specific training at Pensacola Naval Station that led at the time Florida Senator Bob Nelson to fax an indignant note to Attorney General Ashcroft asking, quote, to know what's going on, unquote. And the significance of this is that these guys are based in a small community named Venice, Florida. And their cover is that they're attending flight schools for flying Cessnas and Piper Cubs run by two Dutch nationals, Rudy Dekker and Arnie Riethoff, who have a long history of association both with the intelligence agencies and with the mob. And interestingly enough, the person with whom Mohammed Atta was rooming at the time, Charlie Voss, had been a CIA Contra pilot during the Oliver North operations in Nicaragua, just exactly what you would think that presumptive hijackers would be doing. The hands of intelligence are all over this, and that leads again to the name Jackson Stevens.
Right, who Hillary Clinton worked in the Promise Software case on his behalf. Show us how it relates to Promise Software.
Well, Promise Software is only a small part of this because Jackson Stevens' financial network includes something called Systematics, which involved the White House database for tracking money transfers across the planet and the National Security Agency monitoring of all such money and financial transfers. And the Promise technology for monitoring both the communications and banking operations was again under the aegis of Stevens, Inc., the largest U.S. investment bank with outside of Wall Street with $5 billion equity controlled by Jackson Stevens. As you were indicating, he played both sides of the aisle, close connections with the Bush family, father and son, with former President Jimmy Carter, who was his classmate at the U.S. Naval Academy. But Jackson Stevens, one of his primary operational centers was this small community, Venice, Florida, where we have the presumptive hijackers training and stationed with CIA and mob-connected flight schools, having been monitored completely by the intelligence agencies, passed through U.S. Security institutions and such.
No coincidence.
One of the centers at Venice was the super-secret National Security Agency under the direction of Jackson Stevens. A primary center for the NSA has been Venice, Florida.
Dino, thank you for holding. Dino from Grimsby.
I'm reading a book by a Swiss historian named Jan van Helsing, Secret Societies and Their Power in the 20th Century. His take on the Kennedy assassination was that the killing shot where Kennedy's head bursts open was basically a point-blank shot from the driver, William Greer, who conveniently died 3 weeks after the assassination.
Well, that's an interesting one. I haven't heard that.
Yeah, I've heard that. That's Ralph. What do you hear?
Well, look, I mean, the execution of Kennedy was a triangular affair, shots from three directions. They only have to take the Zapruder films and the Nix films to demonstrate the triangulation of shot. This particular thesis that he was hit at point blank range is without any ballistic or
evidentiary basis. The Kennedy execution was carried through from the sheriff's building, from the book depository, from the grassy knoll, a triangulation of shot.
And
the final shot drove his head back at 100 miles per second per second, exploded his head. The Buddha film is like a chronometer. It demonstrates very meticulously the nature of the shots, the moment when they occurred, and the basic elements of the execution.
Thank you. And so, in other words, don't believe everything you read in the news.
Well, you see, one of the difficulties we have in anything to do with these subjects is that we have to rely on data, on evidence. It's not this is not a free-for-all. It's essential that everything that is done about a high-level crime by those in authority is meticulously documented, and the documentation can be independently accessed and evaluated if you want credibility, and we must have it. And if you don't want to be part of disinformation, because one of the difficulties that people engaged in this sort of research and investigative work and political activism find is that the authorities flood the field with fake information to discredit the legitimate data.
Okay, Ralph.
Now, Ralph, let's go back to the September 11th. I've heard you on WBAI. Can you tell us how Jackson Stevens overlaps with the Mossad, and how does that relate to September 11th?
Well, this is Jackson Stevens, as I mentioned, is a primary figure in the National Security Agency and a multi-billionaire involved in the funding of both political parties. The Houston Chronicle documented in 1992 that the then Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, known as FinCEN and the FBI, were investigating the role of a partner or associate of Jackson Stevens named James Bath in directing money from certain Saudi figures into the coffers of George W. Bush, Jr. and Sr., special agents and analysts from the law enforcement agencies, including the Internal Revenue Service and the U.S. Customs Service, were assigned to this and had documented that Bush's company, the Bush Exploration Company, and which emerged into something called Harkin Energy, had been under the direct investment and control of none other than Sheikh Salem bin Laden and his fortune. Now, Arbusto was the company of George W. Bush. It means Bush in Spanish. The person who was facilitating this was James Bath on behalf of Jackson Stevens. One of the top shareholders of Harkin Energy was the Saudi financial investment Abdul-Taha Bakhsh. He was a very close associate of bin Laden. After George Bush Sr. was appointed director of the Central Intelligence Agency, it was Sheikh bin Laden who appointed Bath as his business representative in Houston. These are people who were working with a man named Khalid bin Mahfouz, a principal of something called the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, BCCI, which is the banking empire involved in money laundering and in drug dealing and in covert terror operations, creating terror apparatuses. Mahfouz and his family owned the National Commercial Bank of Saudi Arabia. This is all, again, documented by the Houston Chronicle and subsequently by the Wall Street Journal. Mahfouz and the bin Ladens were the primary investors in the Bush companies in Arbusto and in Harkin Energy. And the Wall Street Journal on September 28, 2001, Bush Sr. and business have been bin Laden conglomerate through the Carlyle Group. They walked through this major $14 billion investment group that runs most of the defense industry companies. What we're dealing here is the essential nexus of our rulers with the terror apparatus they create as pretexts to terrorize the American people into numbed acquiescence for their permanent wars for the pursuit of oil, for the pursuit of natural gas, for the pursuit of their profits, for the pursuit of their power. And Jackson Stevens is one of the primary instrumentalities of this.
Wow. All right. Listen, we have two more phone calls to try to get to. I don't know if they'll be related. We'll just check. Over to Bev. Bev, do you have a question?
Yeah, I'd like to ask him about Promise Software, which I believe was Israeli made and had a back door so that whoever purchased it, Israel was able to read out all of the information through the software, and also about Permandex, which was also a major Israeli Mossad front for international intrigue, and also Enron, which supposedly was actually a money laundering front for drug money, which the Bushes were in on, and this is why Kenny Lay has not been taken down, because he's probably told Bush, if I go down, you go down with me.
Okay, Ralph, do you know anything about those things?
Well, first of all, as far as the role of the Mossad is concerned, the Mossad is deeply involved in the events of 9/11, and yes, with respect both to the promise technology of Stevens, and with respect to the monitoring of all electronics and telephonic communications in the United States, it is Israeli high-tech companies linked to the Mossad that that, and it has to do with the role of the U.S. and intelligence agencies and the Mossad itself in determining policy for the rulers of the society, the 2% of our population, which according to our Department of Commerce owns 90% of the national wealth, averaging some 14 corporate directorships per person. You should keep in mind as well.
Ralph, elaborate on Amdocs and Converse in relation to what you just said.
And for all our spies out there, do you want to give the name of the Mossad spy babe who was involved in 9/11? We'd like to get that out.
No, that was in the First World Trade Center bombing.
We could discuss the role of the Mossad in 9/11, but I think what you're referring to, it's an article that I'd written in 1993 called Who Bombed the World Trade Center, which documents that the person who organized the bombing of the World Trade Center in 1993 was a high-level Egyptian intelligence agent, and who was also an important operative of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, whose name was Imad Ali Salem. Salem approached youngsters at the mosque of the blind sheikh in New Jersey, who ironically had been part of something called Operation Cyclone, which was a CIA operation in Egypt directed against the then government of Egypt. And this guy, this FBI operative and Egyptian intelligence operative, Imad Ali Salem, he proposed the bombing of the World Trade Center. He recruited to it. He funded it with funds provided by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. He wore a wire to every one of the meetings that he solicited. He made transcripts of those wires. He deposited those transcripts in the offices of the Federal Bureau of Investigation in New York. 50 file boxes of this data pertaining to the proposed and planned bombing of the World Trade Center in 1993. And this, by the way, this is derived from the documentation in the International Herald Tribune and the Los Angeles Times, in the Houston Muslim Monitor, in a whole series of places, the Los Angeles Times on March 7th of that time. And what's instructive about it is that the International Herald Tribune ran a story about a London periodical Impact, which had revealed that the person who had actually secured the apartment, who had provided rental van, who had undertaken the funding for this, was a high-level Israeli Mossad operative whose name was Guzi Hadass.
Ralph, Guzi Hadass. All right, we've got 2 minutes. Can you explain, in relation to the caller's question, what Amdocs is and Converse and what they control?
Amdocs and Converse are monitoring technology for all of the telephonic communications in the United States. Is a technology that is run by Israeli companies. It's a Mossad operation. It's in conjunction with the National Security Agency. It permits the penetration of all communications. It gives a tremendous power to these intelligence operations in terms of monitoring what politicians do, where money is banked. It is a vehicle for determining how policy is to be conducted. It is an expression of the fact, as Fox News and ABC have documented, that over 200 Israeli Mossad operatives were engaged in the United States in pursuing these presumptive terrorist networks. In the little town of Hollywood, Florida alone, there were 60 Mossad operatives, as Fox News and ABC have documented. And what do you think? They were living four houses down from Mohammed Atta, monitoring the activities. Intelligence is all over these events. What we're looking at here, both through electronic communications, through Converse, through Amdocs, through Promise, through Systematics, is the mechanisms through which our people are being manipulated and terrorized to obtain acquiescence in a project of permanent war for oil, permanent war for resources, permanent war for products, with a capitalist system that's addicted to arms production like an addict needs his fix in an ever-increasing...
We've got to have you back, Ralph. We're short of time, but we've got to have you back.
How about in 2 weeks?
2 weeks, Ralph. Can you come back?
I'd be glad to, and I would ask your listeners, please, to contact us at Taking Aim
com and to tune in to us at www.wbai.org every Tuesday at 5 p.m. You can hear us on the internet. Just go to www.wbai.org and go to listen, and you can hear the program on your computer.
Thanks so much.
I'm happy to come back, and I appreciate the chance to talk to you.
All right. Well, we will definitely have you back. That was awesome. We would like to thank Ralph Schulman, David Shippers, and Bob Tasher for coming down and being on this show. And we aren't here next week, folks. We have 1 week off. We're preempted for sports. Perhaps it's a conspiracy that we're not here next week. But we will be here in 2 weeks, and we will find Sleeper and find out where he is. Thank you, Bob. Thank you for being here.
I'm very happy to be here and live. I'm going to run now, and I really want to find out where Sleeper is. I'm concerned.
All right, your final word.
Sleeper, where the hell are you?